Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app.
You know, reproduction is often framed as this like absolute miracle, but fundamentally it's an incredibly precarious biological puzzle.
Oh, absolutely. It's a tightrope walk on a cellular level.
Right. I mean, for you to exist, your parents' bodies had to create gametes, right? Sperm and egg cells. And to do that properly, they couldn't just copy their DNA. They had to shuffle it.
Yeah, they had to literally break their own chromosomes apart.
Exactly, and then stitch them back together in completely new combinations. It's a process that ensures you are genetically unique, but it requires an instruction manual of just microscopic precision.
Precision that is surprisingly fragile, honestly.
Yeah, because there is this massive paradox sitting right at the center of mammalian reproduction. In humans, and well, in most mammals, this vital genetic shuffling relies on a mechanism that actively and continuously destroys its own instruction manual.
Which sounds completely counterintuitive when you say it out loud.
Yeah.
It really does.
Yeah.
So we have to ask, what really happens when the very mechanism meant to ensure healthy genetic diversity is evolutionarily self-destructive?
It is, honestly, one of the most baffling evolutionary dynamics happening inside our cells right now.
And to make sense of it, we can't just look at the surface biology, right?
No, not at all. We have to dive into the deep mathematical currents of population genetics. We have to understand how these competing forces balance out over millions of years.
Well, before we get too deep into the math, today we celebrate the work of the research team from Royal Holloway University of London and the University of Vienna, who have advanced our understanding of meiotic recombination hotspots.
Yeah, their work on this is just phenomenal. Really illuminating stuff for this deep dive.
So let's lay the groundwork here.
Mm-hmm.
Because this reshuffling of genes, meiotic recombination, it isn't just a random shattering of the genome.
Right. The cell doesn't just throw a deck of genetic cards into the air and, you know, stitch them back together wherever they happen to fall.
The genome is highly organized. So this genetic deck is cut at very specific, concentrated areas. We call these recombination hotspots.
Yeah, you can think of them as designated zones, like safe spaces where the cellular machinery is actually permitted to initiate DNA breaks.
But nature has evolved two completely divergent strategies for deciding where these hotspots should actually be located.
Exactly. And the first strategy is the non-PRDM9 mechanism.
Which is the ancestral way of doing things.
Yes. If you look at plants, yeast, birds, and many fish, this is their default system. The cellular machinery responsible for shuffling the DNA doesn't look for a specific sequence of genetic letters. It just looks for what we call open chromatin.
Open chromatin meaning areas where the DNA isn't tightly schooled around those histone proteins.
Right. It's physically accessible. These regions are typically near the promoters of active genes.
Okay, so because the machinery is just looking for structural accessibility rather than a specific sequence of A's, T's, C's, and G's, the recombination process is unspecific.
Yeah, and that lack of sequence specificity is actually its greatest strength.
Because it results in unbiased gene conversion.
Precisely. When the DNA strand is deliberately broken to initiate the shuffle, both copies of the chromosome, the one from the mother and the one from the father, well, they have an equal statistical probability of being used as the template to repair the break.
That unbiased repair is crucial, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It means neither the maternal nor the paternal sequence is systematically overwritten.
So hotspots don't degrade.
Right. They remain highly stable and self-preserving generation after generation. They just persist in the exact same genomic locations for millions of years.
But then we look at the mammalian method, the PRDM9 mechanism.
Yeah, this is an entirely different approach. PRDM9 is this highly specialized protein, and it does not settle for just any open space on the genome.
It's picky.
Very. It scans the vast expanse of DNA to hunt down a highly specific motif, like a precise sequence of genetic code. When it finds it, it binds to that motif and triggers the double strand break right there.
Which leads us directly into the central paradox of this system.
Yeah. When PRDM9 initiates a break at its target sequence, the sequence we refer to as the hot allele, the cell suddenly has to repair a severed chromosome.
And the primary repair pathway uses the unbroken homologous chromosome as a template.
Right, but here is the critical failure point. The broken sequence was the hot allele that PRDM9 specifically recognized.
And the unbroken template chromosome often carries a slight mutation.
Exactly, a cold allele that PRDM9 didn't bind to.
Okay, let's unpack this. If we think of human chromosomes as a massive unindexed database, PRDM9 is acting like a highly specific cryptographic hash pointer used to find data blocks.
That's a good way to look at it.
But, like, the very act of accessing the block corrupts the pointer sequence.
Right.
Or, to put it another way, it's like a hyper-specific key that ruins the log every single time you use it, whereas the ancestral non-PRDM9 method is just a master key that works on any open door.
That is a highly accurate way to visualize it, yeah. During the repair process, the cell physically copies the sequence of the cold allele over the broken hot allele. It literally overwrites it.
Wow.
And over thousands of generations, through this process of bias gene conversion, the specific sequence motifs that PRDM9 relies on are systematically overwritten with unrecognizable code.
So the navigation map is destroyed by the very act of reading it.
Exactly. The non-PRDM9 method is stable, but the PRDM9 method creates this rapidly shifting, totally self-destructive recombination landscape.
And the clinical stakes of this failing are absolute. I mean, if this shuffling process doesn't occur properly, if a chromosome misses a crossover event because the hotspots have degraded, the chromosomes fail to segregate correctly into the sperm or egg cells?
Yeah, and that results in aneuploidy. A gamete ends up with an abnormal number of chromosomes.
Which is devastating.
It is. It overwhelmingly leads to embryonic lethality, severe miscarriages, or profound developmental disorders, azoospermia, meiotic arrest. Mutations in PRDM9 are heavily linked to severe human infertility phenotypes.
The evolutionary penalty for getting this wrong is just catastrophic.
It's out as high as it gets.
So we have a stable ancestral mechanism that works perfectly well, and we have this mammalian mechanism that actively erodes its own foundation, risking total reproductive failure.
Right.
Why would natural selection ever favor the self-destructive method? As long as you can just put this in a petri dish and watch millions of years of evolution play out over a weekend. How did the research team actually test this dynamic?
Well, they constructed a highly sophisticated population genetic mathematical model.
Okay.
To understand which mechanism wins under different evolutionary pressures, you really have to simulate the interplay of the genes driving the process. The researchers modeled the coevolution of three distinct genetic loci.
Let's define those loci for the listener. The first is the modifier locus.
Right. Think of the modifier locus as the master switch. It determines the overarching rules of the game for the organism. Like, does it use the motif-specific PRDM9 mechanism, or does it rely on the unspecific open chromatin mechanism?
Got it. Then there's the targeting locus, which codes for the PRDM9 protein itself. The hunter going out to find the sequence.
Yes, and finally, the target locus, which is the actual DNA motif out in the genome that the protein is trying to bind to.
But the critical innovation of this model, the aspect that truly sets it apart from previous attempts to understand this whole paradox, is that they didn't merely track whether the PRDM9 protein successfully binds to the DNA.
No, they didn't. They mathematically segregated the binding events into two distinct categories, symmetric binding and asymmetric binding.
We need to be very precise about what those terms mean mechanically, because recombination requires bringing two homologous chromosomes together.
Right.
Asymmetric binding means the PRDM9 protein complex grabs hold of just one of those chromosomes.
Yeah, and grabbing just one chromosome significantly lowers the probability of a successful crossover.
What's symmetric binding?
Symmetric binding, however, is when the recombination machinery successfully grabs both homologous chromosomes simultaneously at matching sequence locations, physically tethering them together before the DNA break is processed.
Wait, the researchers built a math model using only two alleles per gene. Isn't that drastically oversimplifying a massive complex genome? I mean, human DNA has billions of base pairs and tens of thousands of potential hotspots. Reducing that to a two allele system seems reductive.
This raises an important question. It does sound counterintuitive, I know, to model something so vast with a simple binary state, but we have to look at what the model is actually evaluating.
Okay.
It's not attempting to map the entire genomic landscape at once. It's analyzing the localized evolutionary pressure at a single hotspot over deep time.
Oh, I see. So the two alleles are just representing the hotspot turning on and off.
Precisely. In population genetics, this diallelic model is perfectly tractable and it doesn't lose scientific generality. It tracks a single hotspot oscillating between a hot state, where the target motif is pristine, and a cold state, where biased gene conversion has degraded it.
So if that target motif is destroyed, the local hotspot goes cold.
Right. And eventually, a new PRDM9 mutation arises at the targeting locus. It finds a new sequence motif elsewhere in the genome, and a new hotspot goes hot. The dialelic model captures this exact Red Queen race of destroying and finding targets with just beautiful mathematical clarity.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Now that the parameters of the simulation are set, we can pit these two mechanisms against each other.
Yes, let's look at the showdown.
The researchers ran the numbers, and they set up a fascinating evolutionary trade-off based on those binding types. Let's look at scenario A. In this scenario, they assumed that symmetric binding and asymmetric binding were equally likely to result in a healthy crossover.
And under that assumption, when all binding events are assigned equal value, the non-KRDM9 mechanism dominates completely.
Wow.
The unspecific stable method wins almost every single time over evolutionary timescales.
Let's dig into the why there. If they are equally good at resolving into a crossover, why does the PRDM9 mechanism lose so badly?
Because PRDM9 carries a massive intrinsic mathematical disadvantage. Mm. By destroying its own target sequences, it forces the genome into a persistent state of negative linkage disequilibrium.
Okay, let's break down the negative part of that linkage disequilibrium for the listener. Because linkage usually just means two genetic variations are inherited together more often than chance would dictate, just because they sit close to each other on a chromosome.
Correct. In the system, the targeting locus that produces the PRDM9 protein is physically linked to the target loci it acts upon.
Right.
Now follow the chain of events. PRDM9 initiates a break at a hot target. Bias gene conversion repairs it by overwriting the hot target with a cold, unrecognizable sequence.
So the chromosome that initiated the break loses its binding site.
Exactly. And because of that physical linkage along the chromosome, the specific allele responsible for manufacturing the functional PRDM9 protein becomes tethered to that ruined cold target generation after generation.
It essentially poisons its own local genetic neighborhood.
It mathematically kneecaps its own potential. Because the PRDM9 protein is constantly being produced by a chromosome surrounded by degraded targets, it struggles to achieve symmetric binding locally.
Oh, because the targets are gone.
Right. It can only bind asymmetrically to the homologous chromosome that might still retain a hot target. Its overall binding rate just plummets.
So it simply initiates fewer total recombination events than the non-PRDM9 mechanism.
Yeah, and if we assume all binding events are created equal, then evolution favors sheer volume. The non-PRDM9 method provides endless stable volume. PRDM9 basically stars itself out of the competition.
But the researchers didn't stop at scenario A. They moved to scenario B. They asked, well, what if all bindings are not created equal?
It is a critical pivot.
What if symmetric binding, physically tethering both chromosomes simultaneously, is vastly superior at resolving into a successful crossover than asymmetric binding?
What's fascinating here is how this single variable flips the entire evolutionary narrative.
Yeah.
When symmetric binding is assigned a higher biological success rate in the model, the PRDM9 mechanism suddenly roars to life. It can outcompete the non-PRDM9 method, or they can stably coexist.
But how does the math actually balance out? Because we just established that PRDM9 produces fewer total bindings because it's caught in that negative linkage disequilibrium.
Yeah.
How does it overcome a lack of volume?
By producing an overwhelming excess of symmetric bindings when it does find a functional hotspot, the extreme sequence specificity of PRDM9 means that when a hot target is present on both chromosomes, it acts like a precision clamp. It guarantees a highly efficient symmetric tethering event.
Okay, so that net gain in highly successful symmetric bindings rescues PRDM9 from evolutionary oblivion.
It really is the ultimate quality versus quantity paradigm. Non-PRDM9 floods the system with a high volume of lower quality, often asymmetric bindings.
And PRDM9 offers a lower volume, but when it hits, it delivers incredibly high quality, guaranteed symmetric bindings.
The math proves that this quality can completely balance out the self-destructive nature of the mechanism. And the model highlights a crucial variable that dictates which strategy an organism will adopt, which is parameter F.
Parameter F represents the fitness cost, right? The fertility loss when a crossover fails to occur.
Correct. If parameter F is moderate, meaning the evolutionary penalty allows for a little breathing room, the mathematical model shows something remarkable.
The stable coexistence of both hotspot types.
Yes. They actually cause cyclical oscillations over evolutionary time. A species will rely heavily on PRDM9 until the targets are too degraded. Then the non-PRDM9 mechanism buffers the system while new PRDM9 mutations arise.
Creating this endless swinging pendulum within the DNA.
Exactly.
The idea of an evolutionary pendulum swinging back and forth within the architecture of our genome is incredible. But, you know, a mathematical model is just a simulation.
True.
How did these equations map onto the actual physical animal kingdom? Does the genomic record of life on Earth actually back this up?
It maps onto the phylogenetic tree with striking elegance, actually. We know from sequencing data across diverse species that the non-PRDM9 mechanism is unequivocally the ancestral state.
But then PRDM9 shows up very early in the vertebrate lineage.
It evolved right before the common ancestor of all vertebrates. So our early vertebrate ancestors adopted this highly specific self-destructive mechanism.
Right.
But here is where the model's predictions about parameter F and selective pressure truly align with reality. PRDM9 was not a permanent evolutionary commitment for every branch of the vertebrate tree.
Because as species diverged, their genomic architectures changed.
Precisely. PRDM9 was independently lost in several distinct major lineages. Birds lost it entirely.
Yeah.
Crocodiles lost it. Even canids, modern dogs and wolves, they lost it. They stripped PRDM9 out of their genomes and reverted entirely back to the ancestral non-PRDM9 method.
And what about the predicted coexistence? Are there species that actually use both mechanisms simultaneously today?
Yes, absolutely. The model predicted that intermediate selective regimes would allow both mechanisms to function at the same time, and we see exactly that in several snake species.
No way.
Yeah, they maintain active recombination hotspots directed by both PRDM9 and non-PRDM9 mechanisms concurrently.
That answers the math, but it still begs a massive physical question. Why would the advantage of symmetric binding, that high-quality simultaneous tethering, be so critical for human reproduction, while a wolf or a bird gets along just fine without it?
This brings us to the chromosome size hypothesis. It centers on the physical dimensions of the genome itself, specifically what researchers call the homology search space.
Let's frame the search space. We are talking about homologous chromosomes trying to physically find each other and align in the nucleus before they can exchange genetic material.
Right.
If they misalign, the crossover is catastrophic. And aligning them isn't simple, it's a massive computational and physical problem for the cell.
Think back to your analogy of an unindexed database. If you have a relatively small data set, the cellular machinery can scan through it and find matching strings of code without much specialized help. The baseline rate of unspecific binding is enough.
But humans do not have a small data set.
Not at all. Humans have physically massive chromosomes. Our average chromosome is about 149 million base pairs long.
Wow.
Yeah. Navigating that massive homology search space is incredibly difficult. PRDM9, by forcing symmetric binding at specific matching sequence anchors, acts as the ultimate sorting algorithm. It forces these massive unindexed strings into alignment at predetermined points.
We need PRDM9 to help our massive chromosomes find each other safely.
Exactly.
And the lineages that lost PRDM9.
If you look at birds, they possess a vast array of microchromosomes. A heron's average chromosome is only about 38 million base pairs long. Canids, like wolves, average around 70 million base pairs.
So they're much smaller.
Their homology search space is significantly smaller, much more physically constrained within the nucleus.
They don't need the specialized sorting algorithm.
Exactly. They don't need the highly specific symmetric binding assistance that PRDM9 provides. Because the chromosomes can find each other relatively easily, the evolutionary cost of PRDM9's self-destructive target erasure suddenly outweighed its benefits.
Natural selection optimized for efficiency and simply ditched the PRDM9 mechanism, reverting to the reliable, unspecific method.
You got it.
So what does this all mean? We have a stunning mathematical model that aligns perfectly with the evolutionary history of vertebrates, the mechanisms of biased gene conversion, and the physical realities of the homology search space. But, you know, no model is perfect. What are the limitations of the math used here?
Well, it is vital to acknowledge that this study, for the sake of mathematical tractability, assumed an infinite population size in its core framework. In the real world, biological populations are finite.
And finite populations are subject to genetic drift, right? The random fluctuations of allele frequencies over time that have nothing to do with fitness.
Mm.
Does genetic drift break the model?
It doesn't break it, no, but it certainly adds noise to the data. Genetic drift can make the transitions between hot and cold hotspots more irregular or temporarily fix a disadvantageous allele in a small population.
But the core findings hold up.
Yes. it does not overturn the core deterministic predictions of the model. The fundamental selective pressures remain intact. The physics of the homology search space and the evolutionary trade-off between binding volume and symmetric binding quality do not fundamentally change just because a population is finite.
The evolutionary fate of recombination mechanisms is a delicate trade-off between crossover quantity and quality. While PRDM9's picky, self-destructive nature reduces overall binding events, its ability to force symmetric binding ensures highly successful crossovers in large, complex genomes.
It's a beautiful, chaotic balance.
What does this mean for our future ability to treat human infertility if we could therapeutically manipulate these symmetric binding events?
That is the million-dollar question for the next era of genomic medicine.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
Some marks are scattered, some are drawn. A hidden map we're walking on. If you bind too often, you pay the cost. Connections blur and chances get lost. But when the meeting's mirrored side by side, that's where the crossover can. Genome seed.